Award-winning journalist Bob Smetana has been covering and uncovering the way Southern Baptists have been handling charges of sexual misconduct over many years. With the release of a long-anticipated report this week, confirming at last, which many have been trying to say, Bob finds no joy in the validation of his work, but is working furiously to make sure Religion News Service coverage keeps up with this dynamic story. Bob, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Glad to be here.
Bob, what is it that happened this week that has everyone talking about abuse and the Southern Baptist Convention?
So this past weekend, there was a release of a report that was commissioned last year by the what are called messengers, which are local church delegates from the Southern Baptist Convention, into how its leaders have handled the issue of sexual abuse, in particular at their executive committee, which is a national office that kind of oversees the convention during the year. It's not quite the national headquarters, but it's something along that lines. And that report found that for years, the staff of the national office had used Baptist polity, which holds that every church is autonomous, as a way to say that sexual abuse was not their problem. And they sought to basically protect their liability, and that if that meant mistreating sex abuse survivors, not talking to them, looking the other way, calling them part of a satanic plot, then that's what they did.
So you've written about these charges for a long time and about the denials that have been swirling around the SBC and other close-knit religious bodies and the frustration of watching the obvious be denied time and time again. Would you share just a little bit of your history with this story?
Sure. So I began covering the Southern Baptist Convention in 2007, right about the time they were looking at putting together a database. There had been an ABC News report about abuse in the convention and other Protestant groups, and the messengers had said, well, we should look into having a database so that we could track if there's an abusive pastor and they get caught, we want to know so that we can check before we hire someone if they're an abuser. And the executive committee's lawyer said that we could probably do that, but the other leaders there stymied that. So in 2008, at their annual convention, they announced that, no, we cannot have a database. The irony is I was sitting in their convention hall, and they had a database of all the pastors in the convention. So I just looked up on Google, Baptist conviction abuser, found some names, plugged in the database, found about a dozen people in about an hour, and wrote a story about it. And so they'd had this list of pastors, which was a directory. And they actually, it turns out, according to this abuse report, that they had a list of pastors who'd been convicted of abuse that they kept secret. So there's been following it for a long time. There's been pushes to get them to address abuse. Last year came to a head when, ironically, with the departure of Russell Moore, who's the Southern Baptist ethicist, he had, after 2019, the Houston Chronicle did a big report on abuse in the church, and people began to say we should do something better. And when Moore began to support survivors, he began to get a lot of pushback, especially if those survivors criticized national leaders. So he didn't release a letter. We were leaked a copy of the letter, which did not come from him, about his concerns. And that really got a lot of uproar, which caused some Baptist pastors to say, look, our executive committee has some explaining to do. And let's put together a motion from the floor of the convention that says we need to investigate them.
You know, some of our listeners are familiar with trying to pull out a tree stump or a fence post that's dug deep, and it won't budge and it won't budge and it won't budge, and then all of a sudden it pops out. What made this report pop out finally at this time?
A number of things happened. I think the post 28. So in 2018, Paige Patterson, who's this very famous Southern Baptist leader, was fired from the seminary he ran because he had mistreated a student who'd been raped and tried to cover it up. And there's a line of him saying he was going to break her down, get her to not talk about the charges. He ended up being fired. Then we had the Houston Chronicle report. And then we had a kind of a lament. So the in the air is that there was an acknowledgement that there was a problem, and these concerns that the executive committee had been mistreating survivors had been circulating for a while, but the Moore letter really sort of brought that to the surface. That and the departure of Beth Moore, who was a famous, is a very well-known Baptist Bible teacher. She left the convention in part because she was sort of harassed out of it. And at one point she talked about being, right after the Houston Chronicle report was released, she talked about preaching at a church and said, and all of a sudden, nobody wanted to talk about sexual abuse. They wanted to talk about, you know, Beth Moore and women preachers who were, you know, going to threaten the church. So this was all in the air. But when Russell Moore's letters came out, that really pushed people to say, wait a second, what on earth have our leaders been up to? They have been telling us all along we can't do anything. We don't think that's satisfactory. So last summer, they put together a motion to say, and the Southern Baptist Convention is a democratic body run by Robert's Rules of Orders and Bylaws. So they got up, if you've ever been to a church meeting or a community meeting, it's just like those, only with 17,000 people. So they get up, they say, we want to have an investigation. The executive committee, from the minute they heard someone say investigation, tried to cut it off. First, they started by saying, well, we'll just do our own investigation. Then they tried to refer the motion to have an investigation to a committee. And actually, this investigation pretty much was dead in the water last summer for about 3 minutes till one pastor got up and said, I would like to make a motion to overrule the chairman and say that we should have a vote on this investigation. And the minute he said that, there was kind of an uproar in the crowd. They have a vote. Almost everyone, they have little yellow cards they use to indicate they're voting. So the whole, there's a sea of yellow cards, almost no one against it. And, you know, the next day, or actually a few hours later, they voted to get the investigation going.
That's really something. Are we seeing a level of accountability that is commensurate with what was in the report and what seems to be the will of the convention at that gathering?
It remains to be seen, because the leaders of the convention tried very hard to stymie this report. Even after, so one of the key points was that they were going to waive attorney-client privilege, because a lot of this back and forth about how to deal with abuse was included communications with the lawyers. And even after the messengers said, you should waive attorney-client privilege, the executive committee fought very hard not to do that, because they didn't want anyone to see what was in the report. They didn't want anyone to see what was in the communication with lawyers, and they certainly didn't want that to become public. So now that it's public, there is a push to respond and to say yes. I think one thing that's really remarkable about this is, I think, the first time in covering abuse that I remember that basically a congregation or lay people have had a say. So in the Catholic Church, the bishops decided, and the lay people voted with their feet, you know, and didn't stop coming to church, and maybe their pocketbooks, but they didn't have an actual process vote. At big mega churches like Willow Creek or Mars Hill, where there's been abuse, there was no one who could get up and say, those churches are run mostly by from the top down. Here you had a place where the leadership, where the group of lay people had a chance to vote, and they voted overwhelmingly that we want to know what you've been up to, and we want to treat our people well. Now, the problem will be, can this happen? There does seem to be, there's going to be a hotline. There's going to be some commitment to investigating concerns. We'll just have to see. But there is at least motion to say that this can't, and a repudiation of the past. So there's motion to say that we can't do what we did in the past. Will it have enough momentum to carry it forward? We don't know.
I don't want to call these merely cosmetic changes, but they're not going deep with what you've just described. Is there any indication you've seen that there are going to be lasting changes that might result from these ugly revelations?
Again, we'll have to see. I think there will be changes, at least that if someone says there will, for at least the short term, if someone says there's an abuse investigation, there's a place to report and at least one of the groups. So they have a group called the North American Mission Board, which does church planning and kind of missions in the U.S. They have said that they're going to hire the same committee that did the Guidepost Solutions, which did this national report, to investigate any claim. So I think there is more, this movement towards that. Their bigger problem is, you know, every church is autonomous, and there is no one to who can say to those churches, this is how you should handle abuse. And often those churches are run by lay people. They're very small. They don't have the capacity. So there's a lot of education. And then there's just a kind of sea change that needs to happen in the way people see this, that when there's abuse, we got to call the police. These people should be disqualified from ministry. There has been a long time to, as in any group, you want to hide your bad news. Let people go quietly, cover it up. And, you know, especially when it involves a church leader or pastor, there's been a sense that, well, if they confess and said they're wrong, that just is, then it's all done.
Yeah. So I want to go just a little bit deeper there. What is it about the free church structures of a lot of evangelical congregations that make this kind of accountability particularly hard to establish? Are there any structures in place that can reduce that problem, or even propose that can reduce that problem?
It's difficult. There's two things that are happening. One is there's kind of an overconfidence that they have spiritual power and discernment to do this. And the second is a kind of reluctance to ask outsiders for help. Because some of the groups that, you know, if you're a conservative evangelical, some of the groups that have more structure, some of the mainline churches, Catholic churches, are not churches that you see as someone you, as peers. There's people who have different beliefs. They're not someone you're going to ask for help. So there's that kind of part. I think there's also one of the problems is that it's very difficult if you have a pastor who preaches every week, who's a person who shows up in your hospital, is someone that you revere, and you kind of, who is someone who's cared for you, you know, when you're sick or did the wedding or did the funeral. They're a beloved figure. It's very hard to think that person did something wrong. And then it's very hard to say, what do we do? Because all of a sudden you find out there's a committee, and the committee of lay people, volunteers, they say, wait, our pastor did this. Well, we have to investigate it. And then what do we do? And then people are going to know about it. So there's the kind of hands-on involvement of lay people in some ways works against them doing anything, because you have to get a whole committee of people to decide this. I think it's some of it's just human nature, that people forget that churches are human institutions as much as they're spiritual institutions. When we think about the spiritual part and we think about the ideals and the ethics, but the hard part is like how you put those into practice with fallible human beings.
So here's a question you may or may not be able to answer, but you have more background than most of our listeners. Does the Southern Baptist Convention's looser governing structure make these abuses any more or less possible than in the hierarchical denominations and communities, both in Christendom and outside of Christendom?
I don't think so. Because if you look at what's the biggest abuse scandal we've seen, the Catholic Church, hierarchical, very top-down, very structured organization. I think that the problem often becomes, whatever organization is, there's a problem of what they call clericalism, where the clergy are seen as special. There's a and you see this in Protestants and Catholics, and you see it, I'm sure, in Jewish communities and other communities. The spiritual leader is seen as someone special and above reproach. So if you come along and say this person has acted immorally or illegally and injured people, it's hard to, they have an esteem level that you have to penetrate. They're like a celebrity. They have the kind of love and affection. It's very difficult to get past that. But I think this, again, it's the human part of religion, that it's very difficult to see your spiritual leader as someone who's flawed and potentially a threat. And we see this all the time. You have faith in the group and to question that is very difficult because it questions your identity. It makes you complicit in this. Wait, did we cover this up? Were we misled? It's easier to believe that someone is lying to you than to say, oh my gosh, we have been misled by someone or someone has betrayed us. Betrayal is very hard to deal with, especially in religious communities where they're built on trust and love and affection and the ideals. You say that pastor couldn't have done this or the pastor's kid couldn't have done this. And often these religious leaders, especially when it's abuse of adults, when they have had, so often we have abuse of children, but the second part of this is the abuse of adults where a clergy person has a sexual relationship with an adult member. And people see this as a moral failing or as an affair, and they don't see that there's an abuse of power, that the person didn't get to have sex with that person because they're a great person. The person got to have sex with them because they use their spiritual authority to get access to that person. And that's very hard for people to understand and hard to deal with. And so you want to say, well, it's, you know, and some of the evangelical congregations, the woman is seen as a threat. They're seen as a temptress. When you see a group of people being the intermediary between the congregation and God, and there's no one to hold their feet to the fire and say, you have standards and you're accountable, then bad things will happen. Because if you have power, no accountability, then you start to think, oh, I deserve these things, or I can get away with it, or I deserve this because I'm such a good person. And often that's the problem. The clergy people are very wonderful people. They do all these wonderful things. And then they have a secret part of their lives where they're abusive. And people think, well, they were so great. Does it weigh the scales out? We should ignore this. Or they think, if we say anything about this, our congregation will close. You know, we'll lose our pastor. We won't be able to replace them. We'll have scandal. No one's going to come to our church. So there are all these kind of existential problems that come with admitting this.
Listen, there's a long history of celebrating public repentance of abusers on the rare occasions they actually get exposed, and of marginalizing survivors. Talk about why that's important to understand.
I think it's very important to understand. There's a kind of theatricality to it. And catharsis to it. So we saw this weekend. One of the things that happened right after this report is this video went viral of a church in Indiana where the pastor got up and said, they did an altar call. They did something called a sinner's prayer where you say, you know, someone confessed Jesus. So they have this prayer. And then the pastor says, well, I have something to tell you. And I, you know, 20 years ago, I sinned. But, you know, and I've told the church and I've confessed and I'm going to submit to them. I'm going to take a break from ministry. And, you know, and I was wrong and I shouldn't have done this. And, you know, the people get up and applaud like, oh, you know, this is what we want. I mean, we call it a come to Jesus moment, right? People want to say like, right, there's a crisis. You have to say, I was wrong. I repent. In this case, it can be used to say, they can be used in two ways. One, when the pastor says that, there's a pressure on the abuse survivor to say, I forgive you, right? I, you know, Jesus forgive you, so I'll forgive you too. And a kind of overlooking of what kind of harm they do and do you make amends for that? And what happened next in this church in Indiana is that the person involved, the survivor of abuse, got up and said, first of all, I was 16 years old when this happened. It's not an affair. I was a kid. And it's this kind of shocking, just rebuke of the pastor. And then she walks off and then the church prays for the pastor. There's like, it's the most stunning thing, but it shows, I think, the kind of way that works, right? And it shows the way the church can be pastor centric, right? So if you put the pastor in the middle, the pastor's going to come and repent. What could have happened at that church? Say the church got up and said, look, we fired our pastor or we suspended our pastor because he did these things and he admitted them. And we have some person that he harmed. We're going to work to help that person heal. And we're going to hold this pastor accountable. And maybe someday, a year later, when the pastor has made some amends, they can come back and say they're sorry. But they put the pastor in the center of it. And that really, you know, what happens is the abuse survivor is left in the dust. They are seen they're seen as a person that ruined the pastor's life. You ruined our ministry. And I think there's a kind of you know, the thing about religion and spirituality is there is a chance to make amends and to get things better and to get forgiveness for things that you can't undo. Those are all good things, but there also is the institutional part to say, okay, you've harmed someone, there are consequences, and we're going to remove you from this, and we as a congregation are going to take care of the people that you've harmed, and we're not putting you in the charge of admitting how it went and how you're going to repent and how we're going to deal with this. Once that happens, you know, there's and that's because it feels better, right? To the pastor get up and say, I'm sorry, I repented. Sure. And that can happen for a congregation to heal. But it seems like if you try and do it right away and force feed it, then lots of damage is done to survivors. And there's also no accounting for, and also that pastor never changes because they're just like, oh, I'm done.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. I see, God forgive me. Let's move on.
So you cover these stories, Bob, from an unusual perspective. You're not merely a consumer of the information, and you're not a participant in the process. You're an observer and an interpreter. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges of reporting on this kind of story for Religion News Service, and maybe offer a bit of guidance for concerned listeners on where to start working their way through your reporting and that of others to get a clearer understanding of the situation?
Great. Yeah, so we have a lot of reporting up at religionnews.com. We've got a couple explainers about this. The Washington Post does some good work. Robert Downey of the Chronicle does his work. I think that the big part for people, so this is very difficult for us to cover. And because some of the people who cover, you know, these stories also go to church themselves.
Right.
And I think one of the things to say, to realize is that one of the things that religions teach us is that everyone is flawed. That's the whole point, right? People are not perfect. There are problems in the world and they're going to be problems. And the way you deal with those problems is to face them head on, to look at them honestly, and then figure out what do we do next. So I think that's the one part, is to have in your mind that religious institutions and churches, like any other group, is made up of people, and those people are flawed. And that has to be part of your understanding. And the second part is to read, like we have a number of stories just about, and the report is available publicly, to say, okay, what happened here? And then to say, okay, given that it happened, let's move forward. I think there's a kind of idea, but there has to be a lament too. But I think it's really, what we do as reporters is to say, okay, we heard this happen. Now we go vet it. We find out what happened. And then we tell you what happened. And it's good sometimes and it's terrible sometimes. It was very difficult. It was difficult as a reporter to watch the leaders of the convention try to stymie this report. Because we all as reporters knew what had happened for years. We knew that this had happened for years. And when we saw the people of the church say, enough is enough, we want to know, there was a real move to, and we have to, you know, there were concerns that people had about how to move forward this report. Those were legitimate. But there was a real move to say, we are not circle the wagons. And I think that is the more that, I'll say one more thing. One of the things that happened with the Southern Baptists is this. They got a couple leaders who told them exactly what they wanted to hear. That, oh, there are these abuse survivors out there, but that's a problem for churches. It's not our problem. And we're not going to get sued on it. And that's what our polity says. And so our bylaw says, so you can't do anything. And for too long, those leaders said, oh, okay, that's what it is. And they repeated that line. And nobody ever got a second opinion. Nobody ever said, like, wait, I don't care what our bylaws say. What's the right thing for us to do? And there must be a way for us in our bylaws and legally to do something about this instead of saying it allows us to wash our hands. And I think that's the one of the problems. One of the fears in the survivor community is that people will look at this situation and say, hey, well, this is those two guys. They were the problem. And yeah. Now look at the people who, because those leaders were not, they were not doing anything in secret. They were telling exactly what they were going to do. But no one ever said, wait, what are our values here? If our values are we care for people and we don't have abuse, and our bylaws, we have some bylaws, but those shouldn't say that we don't care about people and we shouldn't take action. We have to, use those bylaws serve to further our mission. We don't exist to further the bylaws.
Bob Smetana is national reporter at Religion News Service, which has been offering non-denominational, nonpartisan, nonprofit coverage of religion news for over a century. Bob, this is a tough one, and I thank you for sharing your insights and experiences here on State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.